Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Camilla Russo, and Camilla is the founder of The Defiant, which is a news platform for DeFi, decentralized finance. And if you don't know what that is, that's completely all right. We'll get into it in this conversation. But she's also the author of The Infinite Machine, which is a book about how an army of crypto hackers is building the next internet with Ethereum. And I believe it's the first book published on Ethereum, which is pretty cool as well. And she's also previously worked for Bloomberg, where she covered markets in New York City, Madrid, Buenos Aires. And in this conversation, we got to know Camilla, how a girl from Chile eventually became and has become one of the leading voices in cryptocurrency in 2021. I enjoyed this tremendously. And if you have any thoughts or feedback about this episode, let me know on Twitter at Hey Danny Miranda. Until then, this is my episode with Camilla Russo.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
So, Cammy, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you.
So, yeah, happy to be here. Thanks so much for inviting.
Yeah, of course. So I figured we'd start with your childhood, because the reason why is because you wrote this great book called The Infinite Machine, which everyone should check out. And you conducted a series of interviews where you spoke to all these different people. And you started doing these interviews by starting with the person's life and starting with the beginning of the person's life. So I figured we'd do the same thing here. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to know what your childhood, your upbringing was like.
Sure. Okay. My childhood. Well, I'm originally from Santiago, Chile. So that's where I was born. I guess, you know, I had a happy childhood. I have one brother. And then, you know, my parents divorced and remarried. And so have half siblings as well. Went to school in Chile. Then I decided kind of at the very last minute that I wanted to study journalism. And I guess, like, brief story on that, I moved to Miami briefly, well, or not so briefly, but lived there for 3 years when I was growing up, from when I was 9 till when I was turning 13. And when I left for Miami, my grandmother gifted me a journal, and she said, you are going to experience some really, you know, new and interesting things, and so you should write down your experience in this notebook. And it was like a very cute kind of, like, you know, girl's diary with the little log and like pastel colors, and I really loved it. And that kind of, like, when I got to Miami, I was like, yeah, like, experiencing, like, all these different things, like, meeting different people, trying to, like, learn English. It's just, like, a very different lifestyle than what I had been used to in Santiago. And I remembered, like, my grandmother's journal. And I didn't really think I would, like, use it when she gave it to me. But when I was there, I was like, you know what? Like, actually, I should be writing all this down. And like, it really became a habit for me to write on my journal almost every day. And from then on, like, I think that really is what got me to writing. I just got used to, like, keeping journals, keeping diaries all through kind of growing up and, like, teenage years. So anyway, so that's kind of, like, where my decision to go into journalism comes from. Like, the one thing that I always really loved was writing. So I wrote about kind of stuff that was going on in my life, but I also like writing short stories and poetry, like all this stuff. So it was like between going for literature or journalism, and decided to go with journalism just because it seemed like the more practical choice. Like, I didn't really want to be a starving artist. So I thought, at least I can get a job as like a newspaper reporter and earn like a stable salary. So I went with that. And that's kind of the rest of it's like, you know, going off to college, getting a job at Bloomberg, like all that stuff. But
yeah, I'm sure we'll get into it. But You mentioned going to Miami for the first time. Was there a culture shock, or was because it was Spanish and it Miami's like almost a cultural hub in a sense? So was it more familiar? How did going to Miami for the first time feel from your perspective?
It was, I mean, definitely a culture shock. I think like I lived in a neighborhood in Miami, which wasn't as Latino as you would expect, like lived in Pinecrest, like the school I went to, like everyone spoke English. Even the people who came from like Cuban families, they were like second generation Cubans, like they didn't really speak Spanish. So I was really in like an American kind of neighborhood, with like, you know, like all the things I saw in the movies actually happened. You know, like people, you know, kids rode bikes to their friend's house and like played basketball and baseball, and like there were cheerleaders and like jocks and like all this stuff. It was like really, I think that's kind of like one of the first things that like really impressed me about the US. It's like, oh, like it's actually like the movies. Like I didn't really think it was like real life, but then I realized, okay, it really is.
That's so interesting. You know, I had a friend from Switzerland, and he told me after meeting me and learning some about the stories that I was telling him, he was saying the United States is actually more like the movies. It's more like that than even before. And I thought, and I was like, wow, like that's really interesting to think about. So it's also interesting to hear you say the same thing. So then going past that on your story, it's like, okay, so you end up growing up in the United States in some respect, and you then go to college. Do you go to college in the United States or elsewhere?
No, so I returned to Chile when I was 13. So I did like all the rest of school in Chile. Went to university in Chile as well. Got into kind of like the top university there, and studied journalism. Then my first job was at El Mercurio, which is one of the most read newspapers in the country. And I was reporting for the international section of El Mercurio. Oh, and there's a funny story on El Mercurio too. So this was kind of my dream, like studying journalism to work at this newspaper. So it's like the New York Times of Chile. Like it's like the traditional institutional kind of, you know, newspaper. Interviewing for an internship is like really tough. Like you go and like you take a test in literally like a gym, like full of like desks of like journalism students kind of wanting to intern there. So it was really competitive. But I did the test and got a call back from El Mercurio. So okay, super excited. But then they offer me like a really bad internship, like at the social section of El Mercurio. Like, I don't know. I don't even know how to translate like social section, but it's like, you know, Chile is like a very kind of closed society. So like there's an important section in Chilean newspapers that's like dedicated to like society pages, I guess. So it's like, okay, like some gallery opening, some like dinner party, some famous person got married, and like those pages. So like they wanted me to basically write about that, about like you know,
gossip
or yeah. So I was like, okay, I'll have to get back to you. And they're like, wait, you're doubting whether to like do an internship with us. And I'm like, I don't like, this is not what I signed up for. Like, I want to do real journalism. So I thought about it and then like called them back and decided, like, I told them I didn't want the job. Like, I mean, I didn't want to do like society pages. And then they called me back and were like, actually fine. Like, you'll get like in the international section. So that was exactly what I wanted. So, I mean, that lesson was like, okay, like, it really pays to like go for what you actually want, and not kind of compromise on that. So yeah, so I did the internship there in the international section, like you know, it was just like international global news, and I was there for like around a year after the internship, but after like getting to El Mercurio, which was kind of a big step for me, and it was still kind of like the first job out of university. So I started thinking kind of, you know, what's next? Like, do I really want to stay here for like, I don't know how many years, like, you know, like maybe become an editor, maybe, but like stay in this same place. And so I was, you know, thinking back at like my time in Miami, I thought, well, you know, maybe I should think bigger. Maybe I can get a job at a US media company. So that's why I thought to apply to US schools. Like, I thought, you know, really nobody at the New York Times is going to hire me with a degree from a Chilean university and like experience from this like Chilean newspaper. So like, I need an American degree, like a degree from an American school. So that's why I applied to like different journalism schools here and got into Northwestern, did a master's in journalism there. And that's kind of where I got interested in financial journalism and applied for Bloomberg.
What made you think bigger? Because so many people in that situation, I assume, would have just said, oh, okay, this is the playing field that I can operate under. You know, I'm working in this Chilean newspaper. It doesn't have to be Chile necessarily, but what made you say, okay, I can dream bigger than this current position?
I think it was part of probably having kind of experience living abroad when I was growing up. Like, I already saw that it was fine that, you know, I was able to adapt to a different culture. Like, it didn't seem like so foreign anymore. And then the other kind of important part to it is, like, I think has to do with my parents. So I was brought up to think that I could do anything. So I don't know if this is kind of like a millennial thing, like very idealistic, but really my mom and dad just kind of instilled in me this idea that I should go for whatever I wanted, that I was like capable of doing whatever, that I should dream big. So yeah, I think it was having lived in Miami and having this kind of upbringing of like my parents just like telling me I'm special, you know, like I can do whatever, I should dream big. And so yeah, maybe that's why I thought like I could kind of get a job at a US media company.
And you did. And so yeah. What was that process like? Was it difficult to get a job for Bloomberg? Was it what you expected?
It was definitely hard. So at Northwestern, it was very unexpected of me to go for like a financial journalism job. Like I said, like the reason I like journalism is because I like writing poetry, like very like nothing to do with numbers and markets and finance. Like, that wasn't my thing. But when I was at Northwestern, I decided I should take a financial journalism class because I didn't know anything about it. So I basically said, I'm here, like I'm paying a lot of money to be here. I should make the most of this. and just like, yeah, like at least learn what like the economy is, you know? And so, in that journalism class, financial journalism class, I realized that I actually enjoyed reporting on business and markets. I just thought it was like a very, like a more objective way of looking at the world. It's like the market can give you like one number that is like a consensus view taken from like thousands of market participants and just like tells you something very concrete about a company or a country. So I thought that was really interesting. And I also realized, you know, like things like just like budgets and stocks and like fundraising, like all this stuff like actually moves the world. Like it kind of defines kind of how things survive, you know, or like whether a companies live or die, or like what happens to the different governments. So I just like realized this is like the most important thing that you can be writing about, you know. And also the fact that people reading financial news like make a living off that information. And I think that's very. That's not something you can say with most news. You know, I think most news, people find them as something that kind of, it's nice to know. But for kind of investors, financial news is something that they need to know. So to me, that was like, that felt really powerful to be behind those articles. So that's why I decided to go for the internship at Bloomberg News. And again, like that was another kind of super competitive process, applying for that internship, especially like I didn't, again, like that, like financial journalism class at Northwestern was my first approach to finance. So I didn't know anything. Like I remember the test to get into the internship. One of the questions was, what's Berkshire Hathaway? And I don't think I had ever heard of Warren Buffett or like didn't know who he was. it was tough, but I think like I made up for it with like the writing part of the process, with like the interview, because I'm sure I failed that kind of written test. So but I got in, and then it was like a small class of interns. I can't remember if it was like between 20, like 30 people or. But in any case, from that class, obviously everyone there was there because they wanted to be hired in the end. And that's kind of where Bloomberg hires a lot of its people, like from their internship class. So it was very competitive. And I actually wasn't supposed to get hired after the internship. So as the internship was coming to an end, all of my kind of... you know, fellow interns were getting called. Like I could see them kind of, you know, like getting the phone call and like being told whether they made it or not. And I was like, kind of like pretty sure that I would be hired because I thought I did a good job. Like my team leader was always kind of like really happy with what I was doing. I didn't think I had ever screwed up on anything. Like, so I was like, okay. But then I get the call and they were like, I'm sorry, like, we can't offer you a position at this time. And I was like totally crushed. But then like after a couple of days thinking about it, I decided that I wasn't going to go back home without a fight. And like, yeah, I remember kind of like walking down kind of by Central Park and just like, looking at like New York City, and I'm like, I cannot go back home. So I went back and like asked my team leader, you know, like what happened? Like you never told me I was doing anything wrong. Like I'm sure, like I have more to give. Like I can make a good contribution. Whatever. Like I had like my whole speech, And he's like, okay, like I recommended you to be hired. Like, I'm not sure what happened. So I'll talk to like, and see what happened and see what I can do. And they actually like ended up offering me like a 3-month kind of contract to just like test me out a bit, I guess, more. And then they hired me after that, like test, like additional test. So it was really tough to get in.
Again, why do you think you had the confidence, or maybe it wasn't confidence, maybe it was just, why do you think you went to your manager and said, what happened there? Because it would have been very easy for you not to say anything and just mope and just say, okay, that is what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was just like, I just really, really wanted it, you know, like it was something that I didn't have much choices. I had already being at that internship was like a huge break. I was coming like to the end of my like, so after you have a student visa as an international kind of student, you have a period where you're allowed to work like a for 1 year in the US. So I was, you know, eating into like my OPT, like the period I was allowed to stay here. So it wouldn't have been like easy for me to like get another internship or get a job with an OPT. Like nobody would have just like hired me from like, you know, without knowing me, with just like that, the OPT. So it was like, to me, it was like, either Bloomberg hires me or there's like a very, very slim chance that I can stay in the US. And then I'll have to go back to Chile with like this huge student loan that I took for Northwestern. And that would, you know, just like wouldn't it like the math wouldn't have worked earning a journalism salary from a like Chilean company. Paying for like my Northwestern degree, it would have been like a huge mess. So like I went to Northwestern thinking I would be able to get a job in a US media company, or else like I would have been screwed. Or not screwed. Like, I'm lucky that I have like parents who would have like supported me, but it wouldn't have been ideal. So I really was like, it was like my only chance. And again, like I thought I had done a good job, you know, like if I really kind of had realized, okay, like I blew it, you know, I didn't do a good job. They're right for not picking me, but that wasn't the case. Like I was like I worked hard. I did everything right. Like all the feedback I got from my team leader was like that I was doing a good job. So like, I really didn't get why they hadn't hired me. So I think like all those things really kind of pushed me to at least like try to get an explanation, or at least kind of make my case to why I thought I should stay.
Yeah. And on that last point, I think it's so important. You get confidence from doing what you're supposed to do and doing it to the best of your abilities. Because if you felt like you didn't do it, you wouldn't have had as much confidence to go to your manager.
Exactly.
So then moving on, you eventually get sent to Argentina, correct?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
At what point do you get sent to Argentina to start covering the markets, or what? Break that down for me.
Sure. So I started in the emerging markets team at Bloomberg, and I think it was like after about 6 months, I was asked to go to Argentina, and it was like a bit of a bummer. I was like, okay, like I was supposed to be like, you know, here in New York, but at least like I was with Bloomberg and like there would be like a chance to come back if I wanted to. So yeah, they sent me to Argentina, and it ended up being like the best thing ever. Like it was just the best experience.
Why?
What, like on the professional side, Argentina is like, I think it must be kind of the best place for like a first financial journalism job, just because you get to write about like so many extreme situations in markets. So you get to write about like inflation, currency controls. I got to write about a debt default, about just like crazy volatility in stocks and bonds, about nationalizations of, and like expropriations of like private companies, like, you know, all this stuff, an election. So it's like I got everything. So it just like it gave me a really good background and just like training on how to cover and write about markets. And then on the personal side, like, you know, I was like early 20s, like Buenos Aires is such a great place to live when you're young. I made like amazing friends. There was like such a great group of expats living there. It's just like a fun place. Like people are social. People are like going out every day. Just the nightlife is insane, you know. And I don't know. It was just so fun. I still like some of my best friends are still kind of from that time.
That's amazing. And what happened was your colleagues told you that you needed to take your money and transfer it to US dollars. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened there?
Right. So, okay. So in Argentina has this kind of chronic problem of inflation. And inflation means that currency is, the value of the currency is becoming degraded over time. So you're losing purchasing power. So everyone is very used to thinking in dollars and like living in dollars as much as they can. So, right. Like when I came to the office, like one of the first things my colleagues told me, like, along with like, okay, like here's the coffee machine. It's like, as soon as you get your salary, put it in dollars. and that's what I started to do. But then one day, like soon after Cristina Fernandez, the president back then, was reelected, I was actually covering this, like taking headlines, because like every other day she made something called Cadena Nacional, which is like all the TV networks stopped to show like some announcement that she had to make. Okay, so there was like Cadena Nacional, let's cover what Cristina is saying. And then she starts announcing that from that day on, purchases of the US dollar were forbidden. Like people were not able to buy US dollars anymore. And fine, like I was like sending headlines, covering the story, like harshest currency control since the 2002 crisis, whatever. And then I was like, wait, is this actually true? Like, so I can't buy dollars anymore? And so like, I go into my like bank account online. And before it used to be really simple. Like I had my peso account and I had my dollar account. And I could just like make a transfer between my accounts. And so I go do that. And like, the option is like, simply not there. So it's like, you know, whatever pesos I had in my peso account were stuck. There was like no option to buy dollars anymore. And that like really made an impression on me. It's like, how is it possible that like from one day to the next, like conditions change? Nobody kind of asked me. And like the government can just like dictate what people can do with their money. That was, I don't know, like I could not believe what was going on. And what was crazier to me was that Argentines were just like, they were just like used to it, you know, like they've been through it so many times and they had a system, you know, like there's like this whole kind of black market currency, like black dollar market that's like pretty established and like people, like it's pretty much out in the open, like people know how to use it. So it's like, okay, as soon as the currency controls went up, like people already knew, okay, they had to go to the black market to get their hands on US dollars.
At what point do you start using Bitcoin yourself or get introduced to Bitcoin?
So this is really weird because this was like 2013, 2012, around that time. And so I had never heard of Bitcoin. And then one day, actually an Argentine colleague who wasn't living in Argentina, he was living in Spain at the time. And he messaged me being like, hey, like you should look into this. Like a friend in Argentina told me he's going to this Bitcoin meetup. And I think this thing is like really picking up steam over there. And I'm like, oh, this is weird. And I like started doing some research and saw this was some like internet money, like, I don't know. Like, I remember being like very confused and like trying to find a website for it, but then realizing it's not like a company. Like, it's really weird. Like when you're just like starting to understand what Bitcoin is, like it's not a country, it's not a company. There's no like single website. It's a currency, but like, how can it be a currency? So yeah, I started kind of doing research, talking to the people in the like Argentine Bitcoin community. And I was like, wow, like what an interesting story. Like people are using Bitcoin to protect against inflation, like protect their savings. And so I was interested in it more from like the story perspective. Like I was just interested in this story. Not so much on kind of using it myself for some reason. I'm not sure. I think I don't know, but I was just like more interested in like telling the story. So I pitched it to my editors, and my editors like hadn't heard of it either. And it took a lot of convincing. Like they did not want to publish the Bitcoin story at first, but I was like, no, like I swear, like this is real. And then like Bitcoin really started like making headlines in 2013. Like 2013 was like another kind of like like bubble year for crypto. So then they were like, okay, I guess like it is kind of real. Like people are interested. So I wrote this story. And yeah, that's kind of like the first time I ever kind of researched or heard about Bitcoin, and just like stayed really interested in whatever was going on in crypto since then. Like I was just like always kind of keeping track of what was going in the space. And so as soon as I could kind of go back to writing about crypto in 2017, I took the opportunity to do that and just like was able to really kind of dive into it and just like write about it on a daily basis.
Yeah, because in 2013, you had to pitch your editors and convince them that it was real. But in 2017, they were needing more people to write about it, and you had already had previous experience.
Yeah, no, in 2017, they asked me to write about it. Yeah, so yeah, 2017, I was, well, like after Argentina, I asked to go to Madrid just because like it starts getting repetitive, like writing about kind of the same market for like, I was there for 4.5 years. So I asked to get a job in, it was like a European stocks reporter. It was based out of London, but I asked if I could do it from Madrid. So they said yes. So that was great experience to live there. But like covering European stocks was really boring after covering Argentina. So as soon as like I got the chance to join the like another markets team that was opening up in New York, I took that. And so yeah, I was back in New York in 2017 and writing for this kind of blog on real-time kind of markets analysis. So it was kind of writing about whatever was interesting in markets at the time. So I was like writing about emerging markets in Latin America. And then when like crypto started heating up, I started writing posts about crypto. But then like everyone wanted to know about Bitcoin. So my editors were like, okay, can you actually start covering crypto for like the rest of Bloomberg, like not just the blog? So that's kind of how I became one of the few Bloomberg journalists writing about the space.
And in that time, you have in your head thinking, I want to write a book someday. I know you were influenced by In Cold Blood by Truman Capote and Michael Lewis. So what got you to realize, okay, this Ethereum stuff, there's a story here, there's a book here, and I'm going to write about this in longer than just articles?
So first off, I was like always looking for a book idea. Like I said, like my thing was writing. So a big goal of mine was to someday write a book. And in crypto, like as I was like covering the space in 2017 and like all the craziness that was going on that year, like all the like characters, I always had in the back of my mind, there has to be a book idea here. Like this space is just too crazy. And so at the end of 2017, I was just like determined to find a good book idea. And to me, it seemed like Ethereum was the one big story that really hadn't been told very well. So I just like sat down and analyzed, you know, what are kind of the bigger stories? So like Bitcoin is the obvious one. But that story had already been told. Like there were like a few like really good books on Bitcoin, but nobody had really written the story of Ethereum. And I thought, you know, at the time, like in 2017, I still don't think I really got or understood Ethereum very well. But I did understand that, okay, it's the second biggest cryptocurrency. It's fueling like all these like ICOs, like it's enabling like some sort of craze that really kind of was instrumental to this boom. And it has kind of the ambition to be more than Bitcoin. Like it wants to be this kind of world computer. So I think those were kind of the main concepts that I had. And with that, I thought, you know, it's like already made a difference in blockchain, in tech and finance. So even if it doesn't kind of make it and, you know, there's some other blockchain that beats it, it was still first. It was, you know, it still kind of made history. So it's worth having this kind of backstory of how it, of its like foundational history documented. So that's how I thought it was worth a pitch. And I met up with the author of The Spider Network, David Ehrlich. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, but he was like super nice. Like I just like cold emailed him and I was like, you know, like I loved your book. And his book is like kind of in the same style that, you know, the Michael Lewis kind of style, fictionalized, not fictionalized, but like it was a nonfiction novel. So I told him, you know, like your book is exactly what I want to do. And I knew he was in New York. So like we met up for a drink and just like asked him for like his thoughts and whatever. And he put me in touch with his agent. And then I just like, you know, pitched his agent. I just said like, I want to write a book on Ethereum. And he's like, okay, yeah, let's do it. I didn't take much convincing. And then, yeah, that's how we pitched the story, the book to different publishers and got the deal with HarperCollins.
How nervous were you about writing a book about a story that's still developing?
Yeah, that was a big question. I think the way that I saw it was that I would really focus on like the early days and foundational story. And I would just make sure that I cut the book off at a point where it wouldn't be outdated. So I knew that from like, you know, kind of like pre-interviews that I did to research my pitch and the book and everything, I knew that there was enough material that like it was like an interesting story that there was like already a book in just kind of the early years of Ethereum. So I thought, you know, if I focus on that, in that kind of part of Ethereum history, then, you know, that, and just like make sure that I cut it off at like the right time, then it won't get outdated.
That makes sense. And has it struck you that you went from taking a class in financial journalism for the first time to probably being able to teach one in a 10-year time frame? And I'm curious how much learning or knowing two languages has helped you navigate the crypto space, because if you think about it, it's like cryptocurrency is a new language for money in a sense, and having knowledge of different languages, has that played any role, do you believe, in gaining that understanding?
I'm not sure. I don't know if like knowing different languages helped me. I think definitely living in different countries like helped me understand cryptocurrencies better. Because like experiencing inflation and currency controls in Argentina, that kind of really made me understand why it's important to have an independent currency. I think that was like what really opened my eyes to why Bitcoin is revolutionary, and why it's kind of, you know, why there's a real kind of need and use case for like this sensorless, permissionless system. So that definitely helped me understand crypto, like having lived in a different country.
How much, if at all, do you fear something like what happened in Argentina happening in the United States?
It's really hard to say, but like I wouldn't rule it out, because things change so quickly and in such unexpected ways. I think COVID really proved that. Like in 2019, like even like early 2020, like who would have thought that we'd be living 2020 the way we did? You know, like lockdown, wearing masks, like paranoid about like seeing our parents, like and that just happened like that, like in a couple of months. So I think it's, you know, like it's hard for humans to imagine just like how quickly and how much things can change. So who knows, like maybe the US could get like some very kind of authoritarian government that kind of just like wants to take over currencies and I don't know, like block borders and just like control the economy and have like a more centralized system and block imports and, you know, have like a more closed system, kind of like what Argentina has and what's kind of put it in this, in its situation, and at the same time, that's like very, that's like populist and is like printing a lot of money, like, well, like the US is actually doing right now. So if the US is already printing trillions of dollars in stimulus a year, I mean, it's already like causing inflation, it's already devaluing its currency. So I mean, that's still kind of far off from the situation in Argentina, but you know, it's kind of like, it's not totally like foreign to what's going on in some emerging market countries, like seeing your local currency lose value and inflation creeping in. So, you know, I wouldn't rule it out. Like, I don't think it's like, I don't see there's like a huge kind of probability of it happening, but it is possible.
What are the signs you would look for in regard to seeing a currency crash, other than the president coming out on television and saying that you're not allowed to transfer your money to anything else?
Well, yeah, things like I mentioned, like a government that doesn't believe in free markets. I think that's kind of the root of the issue here. Governments like the Venezuelan government or the Argentine government, who believe that there can be a centralized control of the economy, that's where you need to start kind of like packing your bags because it starts like very slowly, but then like it creeps into everything. And these governments start controlling movement of currency. They start trying to set prices. They start to like intervene in like commerce and exports and imports, and that like really screws up everything. And so yeah, it starts very slowly, but then it like creeps into it, like all the economy, and before you know it, like your currency is just like spiraling down. And then to stop that from happening, governments do really stupid things like putting currency controls, which make people like want the whatever currency even less. So it's like this just like self-fulfilling prophecy, or like downward spiral in the economy and the currency. It's yeah, a bad place. So as soon as you see like an authoritarian government that's populist and that believes that the government should control the economy and have like just like centralized power, then those are really kind of red flags.
Something I feel like crypto, when the more you learn about crypto, the more you are for personal responsibility. Is that true from your perspective? And if it is, how has that impacted your life?
That's a tough question. Let's see. I think kind of my experiences have really reinforced in me the belief that individuals should have control of their destiny and their assets and their data and their information. I truly believe that. I believe in individuals taking control. I believe in freedom, free markets. And yeah, I think, you know, that has definitely influenced me in my life, because I mean, now I'm devoted to crypto. I think, you know, just like it started slowly, you know, it started by kind of that one story in Argentina when like Bitcoin really clicked for me. And then just like having the opportunity to really dive into crypto in 2017, 2018. And, you know, at that time it was like more because I really enjoyed telling these stories, just like a fascinating space. But as I researched and got deeper and deeper in this space, I also, you know, started to believe in the things that cryptocurrency is about, like this kind of empowerment of the people and like taking control. And it's because of the things that I lived, you know, in the past, that like all of this made so much sense to me. So, the impact it had is, you know, as I was covering it, I also kind of started to believe in this ecosystem. And then when I saw DeFi emerged, I saw kind of the opportunity to really build something myself, you know, with a Defiant. So I think that's how it's impacted me, because when I saw DeFi emerge, there was the opportunity, like professionally, to be one of the first like content platforms to be covering this space in a professional way. You know, like what I wanted to bring to decentralized finance is just objective, unbiased journalism, like actual kind of news coverage of the space, not like being an investor with, you know, a newsletter kind of when those are great, but like they're not really objective, like they're not really journalism. You can't trust them to be unbiased. So that's kind of the opportunity I saw in DeFi. But like also like believing in this space and thinking, you know, this is kind of not going anywhere, and this is kind of the future of finance, made me decide to just like go all in on the Defiant. I think that's kind of the impact it made on me, because like if it had just been like, oh, like this is an interesting space, like there's like a market need maybe for like a DeFi newsletter, but I didn't really like believe that this thing was like the future of finance, I wouldn't have gone all in on the Defiant, but because I do, I believe like this is the future, then that's how kind of I built the Defiant into something bigger.
How do you stay objective when you believe that this is the future? You believe that decentralized finance is the future, but at the same time, you don't want to impart that objectivity. You don't want to impart that subjectivity, rather, into the writing. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, at the Defiant, there's an editorial line where it's clear that we're covering DeFi and we are bullish DeFi. So that's kind of something about the Defiant. Like we're not kind of, our goal isn't to be like outside observers of DeFi, but rather being inside the community, like testing things, using it, and really kind of believing that that DeFi will continue growing. But like from that position of believing in the space that we are covering, we cover it objectively in the sense that we're not favoring any project, any network, you know, any one chain or any solution or any one person. It's like, okay, like we are bullish this space, but within that space, we are objective. Like we're not taking like any sides or like having any like favoritism.
Gotcha. And so I have to ask the basic question because it's such a new space. What is DeFi for those uninitiated?
Sure. So DeFi stands for decentralized finance, and it's an ecosystem of financial applications that's being built on top of public and open networks like Ethereum. So these financial applications don't have centralized entities that control money, but rather allow users to have control of their money and interact directly with smart contracts being run on. Smart contracts are like basically computer programs. So you're interacting with code that's being run on decentralized networks instead of with like third parties and institutions. So what's exciting about this is that for the first time, it's enabling a global financial system. So right now, the traditional financial system depends, is closed, like to each country has its own kind of closed financial system. DeFi is open and it's global, and it's gives access to anyone who wants to participate. So it's permissionless, like you don't have to ask anyone for permission to start using these applications.
And is NFTs part of DeFi, or are those two separate entities?
I view NFTs as part of DeFi because I think to me, like, DeFi is like the value layer of the internet. It's basically kind of, you know, you have like digital information. DeFi is digital money. It's like the way how like value can interact with the internet. And the NFTs is also part of this kind of like property layer. It's how you can give digital files value. How you can kind of own like digital files that you couldn't before. So I think it kind of depends how you use NFTs, whether like they are a part of DeFi. So there are, for example, NFT funds. And that is like more like a financial instrument. There are applications that are letting you put NFTs as collateral and borrow against your NFTs. So that's clearly DeFi. So it's like, yeah, a lot of like mind-blowing stuff. Like you can fractionalize NFTs and trade it into like regular tokens, like fungible tokens. So if you look at like NFTs in a bubble, like, okay, like a tokenized piece of art, say, then it's like hard to see it. Like how is this part of like finance? But because like this system is so open and interconnected, you can kind of piece these things together, and NFTs like start to become part of this like new financial system. And I think that's kind of where the future is going, where there isn't like such a clear division between, you know, applications that we use in the internet and the financial system, but it's like the financial system just becomes part of the internet. You know, it's like one more application that we use.
As someone who's been covering this space so long, is it more difficult to cover the DeFi and cryptocurrency when everyone else is talking about it and there's a huge magnifying glass on it, or when it's a time of peace in the DeFi cryptocurrency community when less people are mainstream getting adopted? Which is more difficult for you?
I think it's more difficult when there's just like more attention and more people talking about it, just because like the amount of news like, you know, that's flooding the space. And so it's just like a harder job to like curate everything and make sure that, you know, we are picking the right things to cover and write about. It's just and just like keeping up with everything that's happening and the market. I mean, yeah, there's just like more news to cover, so it gets a bit more challenging.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you're starting to build this media property, in essence, the Defiant. What are some of the most challenging things you found in building a media company from scratch, basically?
Well, yeah, it's been really challenging. I don't know, like the most challenging things. You know, it's been crazy just going from being a writer and journalist to being a manager and CEO. Like that's a whole kind of new skill set that I didn't have before. So, like one thing is like learning how to scale kind of my operation. So before it used to be just myself writing everything that was published in the Defiant. Then gradually it became, you know, a team of contributors. And then, you know, I had to kind of learn how to manage that. Then it wasn't just like content creators, but also, you know, I have developers now working on a DeFi data platform. And like I have the video crew and people working on like social media stuff and like, you know, hiring designers. And so like slowly it's like the needs of the Defiant start growing, or like I need to like just like have people who actually know about design the stuff for the Defiant, or who know about marketing to like create that strategy instead of like doing everything myself. So just like, yeah, like scaling operations, like hiring people, like managing these people, delegating all this stuff. Like those are things I had no idea how to do. Like I didn't go to business school. Like, I don't know. So that has been a challenge, but it's been so rewarding to see it grow and to have a team and to just like build something that hopefully, you know, it will be long lasting and kind of a contribution to the space.
Where do you look for advice when dealing with all these different things that you've never dealt with before?
So I'm lucky to have a group of investors in the Defiant. So I raised a seed round early this year, and have some really knowledgeable investors on board. Like IDEO is one of the bigger investors in the round, and they've been kind of like working with me in a lot of like the strategy. You know, other funds as well who invested in the Defiant have been great. So I think that's one thing. I think especially in crypto, where like we want to kind of decentralize everything, like the VCs are kind of like sometimes criticized, but I really have seen kind of a lot of value in having just like experienced and knowledgeable people on board. So definitely get a lot of advice from them, and just like, yeah, from my family. Like my brother is a serial entrepreneur. Like he's never had an actual job, so like he's been doing this forever. So definitely get a lot of advice from him and my mom, and just like, yeah, again, like my family has been like so instrumental in where I am today. Like I mentioned, like just like having me think that I can do anything, and now just like supporting me along the way.
That's beautiful. So going back to DeFi, I have a question from Sean Dickens, which says, how will DeFi platforms move beyond traditional methods of capturing value? I don't know what that means, but maybe you might.
Move beyond traditional methods of capturing value. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I think maybe like, yeah, but like it just like makes me think, okay, like one way that DeFi can capture value that's different is the way that, you know, like all these applications are getting liquidity from people anywhere, you know, wherever they are, and, you know, from anyone. So like, you don't have to be an accredited investor anymore, you know, to participate. You don't have to have like a minimum amount in your bank account to, you know, go into Aave and, you know, have you know, start earning interest on your deposit, or so I think that's kind of one way where DeFi is able to capture value differently. It just, because it's open to anyone, and that's, you know, that's kind of the whole point of this. It's permissionless. Anyone can join. Anyone can use this stuff, and because of this, I think it'll just, you know, keep growing faster and just like attracting people from all over.
Yeah. And the way I think about it, and let me know if I'm completely off on this, is like the internet is a natural progression because it's open and anyone can use it, and DeFi is that for money. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly. It's the internet of value.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Okay, Cami, this has been great. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we go to a close?
Well, very cliche, but like believe in yourself. Like, have big dreams. Have big dreams. Go for them. Also, read The Infinite Machine. Subscribe to The Defiant. But no, like seriously, like check out DeFi. Like, it is the future of finance. And I think like once you get over kind of the initial hurdle that it's like very weird, and just like foreign, it really starts to like click in your head, like, okay, like this is how money is supposed to work in the age of the internet. Like you're not supposed to like wait 5 days for a wire transfer and like, you know, pay $50 in fees and like wait for, I don't know, like the Swift code or whatever. Like you're just supposed to like transact with this in the same way that you would send an email, you know? And so I encourage everyone to try these apps, and like you'll have your mind blown.
Where should people go to learn more about DeFi in general?
Well, obviously I'll recommend The Defiant, you know. I have a great guide. Hopefully it'll be really helpful, on the Defiant newsletter. It's called Defiant's Definitive Guide to DeFi. And that will give you like a bunch of resources. We have a DeFi 101 section on the website with all the basics, and also DeFi 101 section and tutorials on the YouTube channel. So you can check those out.
Everyone, check those out. They were extremely helpful in doing research for this conversation. And where can people find more from you directly?
Best place is Twitter. If you guys can follow me at Cami Russo.
Awesome. And I'll link all those in the show notes. Thank you, Cammie, for taking the time. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Danny. Thanks so much for the great questions.
Camilla Russo, ladies and gentlemen, hope you enjoyed that about cryptocurrency and her story as much as I enjoyed recording it. Wanted to let you guys know Monday, Wednesday, and Friday are when you can expect new episodes. And if you'd like the video version of any of this stuff, you can do youtube.com/Danny Miranda. Thank you, as always, for listening into the final seconds. It means the absolute world to me that you would devote an hour plus of your time to this episode. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'll see you in the next episode. Peace.